This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
This is First Edition. Today's episode, Rebecca Shinsey comes back. We talk about the June books and do our It Book Knockout Round. In the second segment, S.A. Cosby, the wonderful writer of thrillers, mysteries, Southern Gothic has been called. I don't know. I really like the books. And you've got a new one coming out called All the Sinners Bleed. It's coming out on June 6th from Flatiron. You may know his earlier books, Blacktop Wasteland, Razorblade Tears, an author I really like, and I'm really glad to have him on the show to tell us another reading story. Well, his first reading story, but the second installment of reading stories. That's what's on tap today. Let's get into it.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode.
Rebecca Shinsky joins me again to pick the It Book of June, even though this is coming out on May 31st, such is the oddity of recording every 2 weeks for right now. But I got to say, Rebecca, it's 77 degrees and sunny here, a light breeze.
Lovely.
It's summer. Summer is here. You can't argue about June. You can argue about May. You can argue about September, but you cannot argue about June. It is summertime. It's summer reading time. And I think my list is going to reflect it.
I cannot wait.
Quick note about May's pick. I just saw today that Yellowface by Rebecca Kwong debuted at number 4 on the hardcover fiction bestseller list, which is pretty good, I would say.
That's
it's competing
strong.
With pretty strong for our May pick. And Brandon Taylor's The Late Americans is selling well. And we've got some Twitter controversy, which in our estimation only helps our estimation that it was in the top couple, right? Laura Miller at Slate wrote this review that's getting tossed around. I know you're missing the discourse. But from It Book point of view, all publicity is good publicity.
I actually caught that discourse because I follow Hanif Abdurraqib on Instagram, and he commentated about the Twitter discourse on Instagram.
Yeah.
About the whole thing. So I saw some screenshots. I saw enough to be like, oh, it's Laura Miller having opinions about things again.
And, yeah. Okay. I honestly didn't get into it that much because, you know, I'm treating this like a horse race where I only care what happens for my picks.
Sure.
I'm joking about this, but I'm not that interested in engaging directly with the discourse. That it happens is enough for me to know.
Yeah, that's the trick, is to be aware of the discourse without the discourse. I don't think I can make that analogy work perfectly well for me. But I subscribed to a new newsletter this week that's called something like It Happened on the Internet. That's like, we'll be in the discourse, so you don't have to be. And it's like, great. This is my dream.
That's a useful feature. Yeah, that's a useful feature. There was a post on the site this week about 30 books TikTok is wild about, and like, perfect.
Great.
You know,
I'm never going in that algorithm, but I'm happy for someone else too.
Yeah. So we're going to get to our list. If this is your first time joining us, here's what happens. I have picked a list of 10 finalists. These are candidates to be the It Book of June 2023. It Book being a, let's say, qualitative rather than quantitative estimation.
Yes.
It needs to have one or more of the sort of following characteristics. It needs to be something people read. It sells or becomes part of the zeitgeist from a sales or conversation point of view. Two, it has to be good, right? Mm-hmm. And then three, it has to have some critical esteem. It's like it matters in some way beyond. So like those are the three things that it falls into. And, you know, if it scores a 10 out of 10 for one, it can be lower in the others. It's hard to score a 5 out of 5 on all three, right? It's better to have one high score than three middle scores, even if the aggregate. And we're not scoring that, but you hear what I'm saying here.
Mm-hmm.
Better to have one good fastball than four mediocre pitches, I would say, here for this last week, as I said. So far, our picks have been April was The Wager by David Gran, and May's pick was Yellow Face by Arif Kuang. I think pretty solid so far. I don't think we've missed anything horribly so far.
I picked
Nicole Chung. No, I'm sorry, you're right.
Nicole Chung.
You're right. We did pick. My mistake.
Should have picked The Wager.
But it was our top two.
We'll allow it. Yeah. I stand by the reasoning at which I arrived at the Nicole Chung pick, having not read it or seen it land yet. That's the nature of this. If I can maintain this like 50% success rating across this game for a year,
without having read them.
Yeah, without having read them or seen any, you know, public response to them, I think that would be a big win. I'm not confident that's where we'll go. I'll probably get maybe a third. But so far I'm 1 for 2, and that feels okay.
And people like this segment, so we plan on continuing to do it. A handful of people have emailed in to say, first of all, email is at firstedition@bookriot.com. Pardon me. Really like the email. I respond to all the emails for now while it's tenable. They would like us to do some sort of reckoning/apologia tour at the end of the year to go month by month and see if there's anything
great.
We list. Listen, we knew this is for fun. This is not for history. History should not have its eyes on us, to paraphrase the great Lin-Manuel Miranda for this particular. All right, let's get into it. Again, I picked the 10, and then I had random.org put them into a random order for me. I will say this is the first time I actually tweaked the order, because there's one that I want to save for later that came out number one. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. You can tell me. But I did actually tweak it for content, for shaping the narrative.
A little editorial discretion is acceptable.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah, right.
You're in charge.
It's me and the AI, Rebecca. It's man plus machine. This is the bold new future into which we are.
Is this wandering. Your hot take? Random.org is an essential use of artificial intelligence.
That's right. Yeah. Did you know that calculators aren't people, Rebecca? Had you been clued into this?
Is that how we should do the, like, okay, people, you've already been working with AI. You've been using it for decades. It's your TI-86.
There aren't little math professors in your TI-85 just sitting in there doing your stuff.
The actors don't live in your TV.
Yeah, right. Okay. First candidate up first is I Am Homeless, If This Is Not My Home, a 208-page novel coming out June 20th from Knopf by the great Laurie Moore, who is, this sounds like a dig, because this is what you say if she's not, a writer isn't hugely read. You say a writer's writer.
Yes.
On the other hand, that's who Laurie Moore is, in that category of the great stylists of short stories, short novels. Let's see. A Gate at the Stairs is one that people know. Let's see. What else am I looking at? I think that's the most recent one. But this is in the tradition. This is literary fiction distilled to its like purest essence, right? Yes. Her first novel since Gate at the Stairs. Let me get a daring, meditative exploration of love and death, passion and grief, and what it means to be haunted by the past, but by history and the human heart. You could describe that as literary fiction by itself. And I'm not, that's not, no, if you're going to do it, you go to Laurie Moore.
It's exactly what I want from Laurie Moore.
Yes.
And writer's writer is the phrase that was bubbling up for me too, as you mm-hmm. were starting to say that. That's how I would describe her. Not an optimistic outlook for this type of book against a field that will have some, I'm sure, bigger, stickier, zeitgeistier stuff. But Laurie, you can't go wrong with Laurie Moore if the thing you want is quiet. I think the synopsis used the word meditative, like quiet takes on people thinking about their lives, especially women contemplating their places in the world and changing relationships. I will definitely be reading this. Or that's my intention at this point. We'll see how the summer goes. This might be a tough go for her. I'll be surprised if we end this segment with Laurie Moore on top, but I'm really glad you included her.
Yeah, I'm glad to see that the bots put it number one. So we have she makes it through round one.
Yes.
You know, if you follow people on Instagram or Twitter or the review industry, like the literary review industry, when this book comes out, there'll be a lot of people like, I love Laurie Moore. She's my favorite writer you're going to see. And then it will sell 4,000 copies in hardback. And that's fine. I mean, there's a place for that. But I agree. It would be unusual for this to break out beyond the literary fiction set. Mm-hmm. But
wouldn't it be
in that set, she's a big deal, and a novel from her is a big deal in that set.
Yes, yeah. And it wouldn't be surprising to see Laurie Moore be on the like end of year best of lists or be nominated for some of the more literary leaning fiction lists at the end of the year, some of the awards. So that would be, I'll be interested to see that.
Yeah. So, and a 208 pager, you love to see it. Summertime,
yes.
Maybe it could even be a slight 200. I didn't even look at the format size. You could imagine it being one size down from, I love those little 208 page novellas that are like those quarto sizes. What is that thing called? I can't remember.
Pour yourself a lemonade, sit on the porch, spend the afternoon with Laurie Moore, transition to a gin and tonic. That's how you do it.
Finish it in an afternoon kind of a situation.
208 is, that's ideal. Okay.
That's amazing stuff. Next up, the book is called the 272. I don't know, is it the 272? But it's the 272 all in one number. : The Families Who Were Enslaved and Sold to Build the American Catholic Church by Rachel Swarns, who is a journalism professor at NYU. She's written for The Times. She wrote the book American Tapestry. And this is, I think, I'll give you the synopsis. So this is a narrative nonfiction account of the selling by the Catholic Church of 272 enslaved people in 1838 to save their largest mission project, which we now know as Georgetown University.
Yikes.
And it's following the Mahoney family, which is one of these indentured/enslaved families through the era. And then alongside the story of the Catholic Church in Georgetown. I would say, does this book get a deal from Random House if the 1619 project doesn't exist? Maybe not, but I don't care, because this is the kind of book that will have a moment. It's going to be an extremely tough hang, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it in award season at the end of the year. There are going to be excerpts and interviews all over the place. You know, one of the things that I would have picked for March, I think it was a March, if we had done a March one, was Poverty by Matthew Desmond, because these big, serious social issue nonfiction books that are narrative, they can stick around and become part of the, you know, the ether for how we're thinking about particular issues at particular times. So that's the 272 by Professor Rachel L. Swarns. It's coming out June 13th from Random House. Rebecca, what do you think?
This one is going to take the lead I don't know that it's going to sell super well right off the top because this will be a tough hang. This is a hard subject to read about, so it's a hard subject to get people to trot down to their bookstores and pick up 300 or some odd pages about it. Yeah. But I do think you're right that there will be excerpts, there will be interviews. I'm sure there are some very upsetting headlines to be made about the content of this book, the kind of upsetting that we should all be aware of and thinking about in our country's history. And I wouldn't be surprised to see it get something like an adaptation for Hulu, the way that the 1619 Project did, or for some you know, network or streamer to pick it up and take the material but repackage it in a way that it will go wider than it can when you're asking people to read a 300 page book about it. So I'm going to advance this one past Lori Moore.
The upside here, the upside comp would be Cast, right? Like, or The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
Henrietta
like, there's
Lacks,
some genetic stuff
the,
here.
Yeah.
That's that. I mean, that book sold way more
that's
than Cast.
That's the signal.
But Cast, Cast. It has that potential. I mean, depending what the reading situation is like, and then just sometimes stuff does better or worse in terms of sales because of reasons that are difficult, if not impossible, to parse. But it has that potential. So very excited to see this. Yeah. So that's going to advance.
This is a conversation that's like entirely based on potential. So perfect.
That's right. Perfect. Yeah. We're not accountable for results. Right. We're just idea people here, Rebecca. The next up, our first four-way. Well, I mean, this is a announced first print run of 250,000 copies. So we're now into the realm of selling some titles. Mm-hmm. And this is poised to be this author's breakout book. I think he will join your... I've only read one S.A. Cosby novel. I think you've read them all.
I have,
but
yes.
All the Sinners Bleed comes out on June 6th from Flatiron. And he has won... You know, he's been a New York Times bestseller. These are modern thrillers centering Black people in the South. They're FBI agents. They're sheriffs. It's kind of, is it literary thriller, or how would you put this, Rebecca? You have a better sense of this, but S.A. Cosby's All the Sinners Bleed, coming out from June 6th, is the next on the list. You can speak more about this than I can. I've read one, you've read them both.
I have read them both. Is it literary is a great question. I think it's more literary than most suspense and thrillers are, because he is working within the frameworks of the genre and also using the genre to ask the kinds of questions that literary fiction typically asks, or to do the kind of cultural critique and examination that literary fiction tries to do. The first book was pretty straightforward. The second one, though, reckoned with LGBTQ issues and rights and racism. And this third one, I just read a big interview with him in PW, really reckons with religion in the South. He grew up not far from Richmond, where I'm sitting right now. So it's like extra interesting to me. That is the kind of issue that can get a lot of people to read a book. It can also be controversial. I have not read The Galley of All the Sinners Bleed yet, so I don't know. But it does feel like the steam has been building up for S.A. Cosby. And if there is a breakout moment, it will be this breakout moment. There's a lot of publicity around this. He's a fascinating guy. The books are really well written. This one is tough. I think I'm going to have to advance this book to the next round. Yeah.
Just from a sales point alone, right? I mean, 250,000, summer thriller, the author has a bit of a track record. Is he going to be one of these kind of authors? Yeah,
if it's as good as the first two were, and as it seems poised to be, it could ring all three bells of zeitgeist, it's good, and it has a positive critical reception.
That's right.
So going with that.
Speaking of publicity and personality, in the intro to this episode, which I haven't recorded yet, which you probably have just heard, listener, you will know that after this segment, the second segment of this episode is actually S.A. Cosby coming on to tell a story from his reading life about sitting
well,
on the porch in southeastern Virginia.
Glad I just gave him such a warm intro.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I want to have he's an interesting person, and he's having a big of a moment, and I know he's an engaging person, and he tells a really wonderful story, and stick around for that. But
I will look forward to that.
I would have done the same thing. I think I'm on board with all of your picks so far.
Great.
Now we're looking at someone who throws 101 mile power fastball, and just I dare you to hit it. I dare you to fend off.
Okay.
The summertime power of one Elin Hildebrand and her new book coming out June 13th, The 5-Star Weekend. It has a picture of a woman looking away from the camera out over to crystal blue waters. A print run of 750,000 coming from Little Brown. Elin Hildebrand's 5-Star Weekend, Rebecca. Do you even need me to read you the synopsis? Does it matter?
No.
Yeah.
Women go to the beach and think about their lives.
And something happens, and it's
something
fishy.
Happens. Yeah. And that's not a knock. She's very consistent.
No.
I'm going S.A. Cosby here, though, because
okay. You're going with your heart.
I can reason my way through this.
Okay, let's hear it. I love this rationalization.
The extreme consistency of Elin Hildebrand means that the books will sell well. Mm. Her fans know what she's about, and they're going to go back. They're going back to the well. You're an Elin Hildebrand fan. You're going back to get the same thing that you like. But that very consistency means that there's not usually much new to say about a new Elin Hildebrand book.
You mean her 29th novel? Can you remember numbers? What happened in novel 21?
And most of them are about women on the beach in some capacity. And like, again, I love a book about women sitting on the beach, dishing about things and understanding their lives. But she's not doing something new here. She is doing the thing that she does very well. And she's figured out how to do it. And it works for her. And it works for her readers. And she's going to sell a floppity jillion copies. But I don't think that it can capture the zeitgeist. And I'm pretty sure it's not going to be a big part of the critical conversation. And S.A. Cosby does have potential for all three of those. So he will advance past her here.
Yeah, there's no way this is going to end up on the New York Times Notable Books of the Year list, where S.A. Cosby, he's done that. He did that for Black Top Wasteland. Right. And if he sells, not going to sell as many copies of this, but I think you have to put it on the list, right? I mean, this is, it's summertime. Yeah. You have to at least consider this. And it's even interesting from a conversation point of view. All the comps are like 27 other Elin
Hildebrand books. Novels. Yeah.
Oh, and Nicholas Sparks books. Those are a little of those sprinkled in there.
Interesting. I wonder how her readers would feel about that.
She has her own following, right? Like Weekend with Elin Hildebrand. Remember that piece about, the fan, weekend away in Nantucket?
Yep. It's a vibe.
I think probably of the books I have on here, this will be the best-selling title. I don't think it'll be close for anything.
I totally believe that.
If you tell me. This one I put on here for me, just to have a moment. And you can tell me about it. I don't know if you have any relationship to Richard Ford, but his next novel, Be Mine, which is in the Frank Bascom, that's the main character that was in Independence Day. I'm not looking at The Sports Writer and Independence Day. I think those are both Frank Bascom novels. This is his newest book, June 13th. The dude has won a Pulitzer Prize, right? And this is a known character. On the other hand, it feels like in the vein of Irving or Richard Russo, he's in that generation where it feels as like the parade has passed him by a little bit from an attention point of view. He could be at the top of his powers. This could be a great book. But in terms of people caring proactively about this, I think it's like me and Greg Zimmerman.
Yeah.
And that might be.
What's it about?
Let's see. Well, it's one of my favorite. It's an old man waiting to die. Now in the twilight of life, I don't need to read. I didn't even read past that.
You have my attention.
A man who has occupied many colorful lives, sports writer, father, husband, ex-husband, friend, real estate agent. Bascom finds himself in the most soaring role of all, caregiver to his son, Paul, diagnosed with ALS. I mean, I'm crying already. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, this is not going to compete with S.A. Cosby. He's still going forward here. But I understand why it's on the list, and I appreciate it as well. And maybe it has some juice as a paperback if there's an adaptation, because this kind of thing is really great for prestige TV. Like the Revolutionary Road film was really good, and that's the kind of vibe that works well for it. Like this could, if this is a good book that somebody picks up, it could go to HBO and, you know, get some paperback juice that way. But I don't think he's going to compete with All the Sinners Bleed. So S.A. Cosby advances once again.
Okay.
When you interview him, please tell him that I moved him past Richard Ford.
I'll go back in time a week to that recording and tell him that. Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a tearjerker, sad, and it's a mm-hmm. twin of Independence Day, which Bascom takes his young son to Cooperstown, right? And they go on a trip here to Mount Rushmore, so it has a mirroring thing going on. I'm excited to read this, even though I'm going to cry my face off. I will have no tears left at the end of this. And very sad books can, you know, very sad books, if they're tearjerkers and sort of cathartic, can have a life. They can pick up their own. Right. If they're sad just for being sad, but like there's a When Breath Becomes Air, Year of Magical Thinking here that could happen.
Yeah.
I mean, those are nonfiction, just reading but sad that, books can move.
The Last Thing He Ever Told Me, which I think that's I can't remember who wrote that, but it's on Apple. The adaptation's on Apple TV right now, and it is their most viewed original limited series. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's is a big sad one. So.
Yeah. Okay. What about a bookography of Independence Day by Richard Ford?
I'm here for it.
About that. Yeah, it's you and me and Greg Zimmerman again. Hi, Greg. I don't know if you're listening to the show. Okay. This one is also personal for you and I think, though I think it could sell. The book is called The Puzzle Master by Danielle mm-hmm. Trissoni, coming out from Random House June 13th. Do you have any foreknowledge of this book? Have you heard? Have you gotten a marketing email about this?
The title sounds really familiar, but as I'm trying to generate what I think it's about, I'm not totally confident that it is the book I'm thinking of. So please tell me.
So the comp here is what got me. And then I read, I'm like, yes, let me see if you can reverse engineer the comp from the two sentences of synopsis. All the world is a puzzle. And Mike Brink, a celebrated and genius puzzle constructor, understands its patterns like no one else. Once a promising Midwestern football star, Brink was transformed by a traumatic injury that caused a rare medical condition. Left him with a mental superpower. He can solve puzzles, calculate equations, and see patterns in a way ordinary people can't. He meets Jess Price, a woman serving 30 years for murder. And then they go have to figure out the mystery of the God puzzle. Rebecca, guess who I'm thinking of and who I'm hoping this is at all like right now?
Michael Lewis.
It's fiction.
Is it not Michael Lewis?
That? It's fiction.
Oh.
It's fiction. I'm sorry. I set you up to fail. That's bad stack work. That's
help me. Save me, Jeff.
Robert Langdon and the Da Vinci Code.
Yes, yes, yes. I was so down the line of like, this is nonfiction. Who are these people?
This is nonfiction. If it were nonfiction, okay, 1,000%, right? I'm so sorry.
Dan Brown, put it in my veins.
Yep.
That sounds wonderful. Does it say what the first print run is? Did you see?
This is random.
They don't always release it. Okay, so they don't release it. Hmm. This is a Shinsky O'Neill pick, but man, I think S.A. Cosby's still winning.
Still gonna go through. Trissoni has written a couple other books, The Ancestor, Angelology, and Angelopolis. All New York Times notable books, interestingly, and a memoir.
Yeah.
Not an author I've read before, but an Iowa Writers Workshop grad doing kind of hardcore nerd genre.
Love it.
I'm going to try this. I'm going to try this.
It feels like there's breakout potential there. Like it could catch on and go really big if people like this puzzle solvey vibe she's going for. Yeah. Okay. Well, I got super excited about a Michael Lewis vibe, but I'll take a Dan Brown vibe.
I'm so sorry. My mistake. I got out over my skis. Did not tell you that it was a thriller / mystery.
That was just like Angie a deafening Kim. Silence.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Angie Kim has a blurb for this, which I think is a wonderful distillation of just the blurb as form, like a deconstruction. Like it's a deconstructed taco like you get at a fancy, you know, Mexican restaurant where like all the ingredients are separated, but they're also not the ingredients you would expect.
Sure.
Here's her blurb. In short, : The Puzzle Master equals, in parentheses, The Da Vinci Code plus The Silent Patient plus a sprinkle of Stephen King, close parentheses, times gorgeous writing.
Well, I'm in. That's compelling. Yeah. And she wrote the blurb as an equation. Bless.
Wonderful. Blurb of the year is a good bit. I need to keep track of
formal blurbs. Experimentation blurb of with blurbs. Me. Yes. Yeah. Let's see it.
Yeah, that's right. All right. So you're still moving S.A. Cosby alongside. Okay. I understand.
I understand. Okay.
Next up, The Wind Knows My Name by the next novel by the great Isabel Allende, which comes out June 6th from Ballantine. 272 pages. For those of you who don't know, Isabel Allende is the Chilean author of many books: House of Spirits, Of Love and Shadows, Eva Luna, Paula. She's a world. She's a global author. 77 million copies in print worldwide. I guess born in Peru, raised in Chile, lives in San Francisco. Sort of trans American author at this point. It has two timelines: Vienna, 1938. Huh, I wonder what that's about. Vienna, 1938. I wonder what's going on right there. But then cross transposed with Arizona, 2019, on the border. So this is about moving across, refugee, immigration. I mean, this is going to be a gorgeous, heartwarming book by you know, one of the authors that will probably go into the canon of world literature by the time it's all done. Probably not as well known as maybe she could be. Kind of an interesting head-to-head with S.A. Cobb, The Wind Knows by Name by Isabel.
This is not an easy one. Allende is, I think, criminally underread and underappreciated, which is a weird thing to say about a writer who is so, like, has so much acclaim and has won awards and is appreciated, but just she lives in that category for me of, like, why did this author never get, like, really, really big in a not quite household name way, but in a, like, reader household name way? I want this. I always want Isabel Allende to be bigger than she is, but she's like a known quantity. It will be good. She's nearing the later part. She's in the later part of her career. I would love to advance this book, but I just don't think I can. I don't think it's going to have, it will have the critical acclaim. I don't think it has zeitgeistiness, which is, I think that's the mystery to me about Allende. She's often writing about things that are, like, relatively recent major cultural events and political ideas, and there is a global nature to her thought and how it can be so timely without, like, getting hooks in to the zeitgeist is something I don't understand how and why that's happened. But S.A. Cosby carries on.
Okay. Yeah, and I think this is later in her career. She has a lot of books out, and this sounds like the kind of book Isabel Allende would write, so it's going to be hard to change the story about Isabel Allende. Look, she sold 77 million copies worldwide. She's going to be fine.
She's doing great.
Right. She's doing great. But, and I think, you know, the reasons we could guess about why she's underread is these are works in translation.
Yeah.
These are about non-white people in America, and as we've talked about before, it's hard for those kinds of authors and books to go in the first rank
of
consciousness. It's rare. It still remains rare, sadly.
The other component of my theory about that is also, like, House of the Spirits gets assigned in high schools, especially. Yeah. And when you're being on a syllabus is kind of a nail in the coffin in a way, or at least can contribute to it. Right
now,
right. If this author was homework for you when you were 15, how are you going to get convinced to pick them up for funsies when you're 25 or 35 or 50? It's just a hurdle for, I think, a lot of folks.
I will be reading it. And again, the people who are interested in, like, canon level work track this. She has, I think, some book club fandom potential, but I don't think it's in a Barbara Kingsolver kind of way. That book continues to sell, by the way. I had civilians ask me what I thought of Demon Copperhead when
That's
I was away
happened
this weekend.
To me. As well. Yep. That's been really surprising. And I think you're on to something here with Allende, that Allende readers will read this, but we're probably not making new Allende readers out of this book.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting place to think about how to position some of our thinking about the It book, this construct that means nothing. It's like, is this book going to bring new people to this person?
Mm.
Right. And I think with Razorblade Tears, All the Sinners Bleed, the groundwork is set up for him to continue on. All right, next up, Page Boy by Elliot Page, coming out from Flatiron Books on June 6th. It is the memoir of Elliot Page, the Oscar-nominated star who captivated the world with his performance in Juno, finally shares his truth. If you do not know, this is a story of gender transition and being in Hollywood, and it has a 750,000 copy print run. Rebecca, what do you think?
Is this the one you had to move up in the lineup?
Yeah, you guessed it. It is. It is.
Yeah, this one's going right to the top of the pile. Yeah. Huge book from a huge voice and really important. Elliot Page has been doing so much work over the last couple of years sharing his story, mm-hmm. and is one of the first mainstream celebrities, maybe the first really mainstream celebrity to transition after becoming famous. And I can't imagine what that's like at all. And just so he doesn't owe us this story, but I think he recognizes the power of that kind of fame and the power of the kind of platform that he has and is taking it very seriously. This will be interesting on 25 different levels and important. Talk about interviews and headlines and excerpts.
It's going to be a cultural event.
It's going to be a cultural event. This is right to the top. If I were you, I also would have been like, there's no way I can mention this first, or every other book will fail on this list.
Maybe you should put it at 11 out of 10 for those purposes.
That's a good question. Are some books too big to be featured on the It Book competition? It's hard to imagine that this, I can't imagine what would have to happen in the world for this book to not be a really big deal.
Yeah. The discourse alone, God help us all, and especially Elliot, though he has already been in the discourse. It's not going to be new. Also, what a fortuitous, both a fortuitous and well-selected title. Page one, a great title for
It's great. Very clever.
Of a book about this subject and this person with this name.
Yeah.
So, sidebar, point of order / behind the scenes. The next two, again, it's not gonna take over from Page. Should I have put Page Boy 10?
I don't think
so. If I'm gonna stack the deck, why not put aces up my sleeve? Why put kings up there?
Well, I don't know. Actually, I would be curious what listeners would think about. Should we save the most exciting one for the very end as some kind of reveal? Or is it still interesting to hear the next two, even if one has already won this? Because I think really the function of, as fun as the conceit of this game is for us to make, and I think it's fun to listen to, the function of the segment is, here are 10 interesting books to pay attention to next month. Yeah. So does it, how much, outside of the conceit of the game, how much does the order matter? I don't know.
Maybe what I should have done is, when you said, is this the one you moved? I should have said, I can't tell you. Right. Because then maybe there is another bomb to drop here at the end where,
a little mystery.
Then there's at least that tension.
Can neither confirm nor deny.
Neither confirm nor deny. That's right. Next up is Watch Us Dance by Layla Slimani, translated by Sam Taylor, coming up from Viking June 20th. So this is a super interesting book because this is her next novel, and it's a global literary thriller. The last one she wrote was called The Perfect Nanny, which sold great and was on the 10 best books of 2018. So this would go in. I'm going to make a case for it, not to take out Page Boy, but why it's on the list. That's why I'm thinking about this now. Mm-hmm. Talk about a breakout. It's hard with books like this because this is one of those, this is not Jane Harper writing a book every year. This is a every 5 year kind of a book. Interracial family, rebellions in the 60s, multiple generations, but also it's page turny, right? It's dishy, it's kind of sexy, and there's other stuff going on. I think number two on Vanity Fair, France's annual list of the 50 most influential French people. I didn't know what to do with that. very interesting.
She might win this game if we were recording in Paris.
I think probably that means she could drink me under the table and wear clothes I can't even imagine buying, is what I think that means right there.
Yes.
So I'm really interested in this. This is a reader. This is an author I think more people would enjoy reading if we could somehow get them to know about it. Mm-hmm. She has several titles, Home Fire. There's another one I can't think of right now. Oh, In the Country of Others. And using if you've read three, they're one of your authors, she qualifies. So I'm looking forward to this. It's just in the mushroom cloud of page boy that just happened. It is feels like an anticlimax from a reading from a fiction reading perspective. This might be my number one pick on the on this list.
Yeah, I was just looking at the other titles we've talked about so far, and of the fiction, I think that she would outperform. She might outperform all the fiction except for S.A. Cosby. Well, she's not going to sell more copies than Hildebrand. Yeah.
No.
She won't outperform Hildebrand, but she can. She's going to hold her own against Laurie Moore and Richard Ford, I think, and probably Puzzle Master. And if the we'll see how the marketing goes. She's one that I've been intending to read, but just haven't gotten to yet. So I'll really be following that. Like if you if this is her third and you read it and she stays, like now she's one of your guys.
Yes,
I'll really be paying attention to that.
Yeah, the last one. Well, I'll be curious to hear what you think. I don't think it contends, but there's a world in which it has to be considered. Coming out June 13th from Berkeley, it's Allie Hazelwood's new book, Love Theoretically. Allie Hazelwood has turned into a romance darling. This is the number one draft pick for summer reading from someone in my house who may have pre-ordered it on their phone to read, you know, outside. Hazelwood specializes in these illustrated commercial romance paperback originals, but she will find people with interesting jobs. And Michelle loves these because they're like scientists. And these are physicists. Rival physicists collide in a vortex of academic feuds and fake dating shenanigans. You don't need to know anything else.
Perfect.
She's really, these are really fun. I read a couple of hers. It's in the Love Hypothesis was the breakout one, but there's also Load to Love You, Love on the Brain. The comps are like Jasmine Guillory, Helen Huang, Emily Henry, you know, the usual suspects there. This is going to sell a lot. It's Berkeley since there's not a print run. Rebecca, what to say about Allie Hazelwood and this genre and this title?
Yeah, Pageboy is going to win this month for me, but now I'm thinking about the runoff between S.A. Cosby and Allie Hazelwood.
Second place, silver medal. You still get on the podium, Rebecca.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting head-to-head because outside of the people recording this podcast, I don't know that Cosby and Hazelwood really compete for readers.
That's it. Maybe only us will be reading both of them, maybe even consider it.
I think that that overlap in the Venn diagram is pretty small. So it feels constructed to be like which one of them would win because I just don't know that they're in a head to head. Maybe I'm going to give them a tie for silver here.
Okay.
And I feel good about that. But it's hard to, I mean, Elliot Page is going to be, or maybe it's a tie for bronze. Elliot Page is going to be like so far above everybody else.
Oh, I see.
For this month. Yeah, that book is so big. Nobody's getting silver, but then Cosby and Hazelwood can hang out for bronze and just be happy to be in the warm glow of the Page Boy success.
Yeah, that's right. I agree with that. I mean, here's one that I don't quite understand. I would rank Love Theoretically above The Five-Star Weekend by Elin Hildenbrand, but I don't know why. They're both category.
Me too.
They both do kind of one thing. Maybe I'm just more interested in that one thing. Maybe there's not 29 Allie Hazelwoods already. We're on number four versus 29.
They're newer. It feels, I was having the same thought. It feels a little shinier to me, a little more clever.
A little more of a wink to it, I guess.
Yes.
Maybe that matters.
There's something to this new flavor of like functionally rom-coms that have these illustrated covers, and there's something very Efron-esque. I think they're all trying to tap in to that Efron thing, that magic thing where the characters are clever and interesting and they happen to be in these romantic and ridiculous situations.
Very high concept conceits. Yeah.
They're just a little more, the brow is a little higher and they're more fun.
It's just a little more fun.
It's like a little more fun, a little higher brow than the Hildebrand.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's right.
All right. Well, it was a difficult month to, we had the clearest number one I think we've had. What an interesting field as always, July and August and September, lots of stuff going up. You can find the list of the books here, show notes. They're going to be bookriot.com/listen, but also with the podcatcher of your choice. Shoot me an email, podcast. Gosh darn it, I'm still doing the old show.
We're on too many podcasts, Jeff.
First edition at bookriot.com. Also in the show notes, you can find the links to the first edition Instagram, Twitter, and newsletter. I'm doing some stuff there. You can follow along there. If you have a chance, rate and review on Apple Podcasts. That's very helpful. And shoot me an email, firstedition@bookriot.com, with feedback, anecdotes. Had some people on Instagram comment about, you know, they picked up the wager. They really like that. Great. So enjoy this time. Rebecca, thank you so much as always. And
always a pleasure.
That's three in the title. And we'll talk to you soon.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee. So I am super excited about this one. It has what sounds like a really interesting, unique magic system. It is a medical magic system, and the world is based in a Vietnam-inspired fantasy world. And it follows Nika, who is what you call a blood carver. And blood carvers are these beings who can alter human biology with a single touch. Now, to people like Thumis, she is a monster who can be traded for gold. So one day she gets caught and she's forced to heal the last witness to a high profile murder. And all signs in her investigation point to an alluring physician's aide, Cochin. But then she discovers Cochin is not who he says he is. And she's suddenly faced with a greater evil lurking in the city. Now, her only chance to survive lies in a choice. She can become the monster the city fears or risk the future of her kind. Amazing. I'm so excited. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
All right, time for S.A. Cosby to tell us a reading story. For those of you who don't know, he writes mysteries, thrillers. I don't know. I really like them. There's sheriffs and people looking into crimes. Been called Southern Gothic. Take it for what you will. I find these very atmospheric and gripping, and they're about something. And I think he's on the cusp of breaking out again. He's already broken out. New York Times notable books, New York Times bestsellers. But maybe a household name thing happening. I feel it. I hope that really happens. So glad he agreed to come on and tell us a story from his reading life. So here we go.
So when I was a kid, about 12 or 13, my aunt, who lived next door to us, I'm from Southeastern Virginia, and me and my mother lived, and my brother lived with my grandmother, grandfather. They lived right next door to my aunt. My aunt lived in a trailer, and me and my grandparents lived in this sort of big ramshackle farmhouse. And my aunt was a voracious reader, like my mom and like my grandmother were. And my mom read romance novels, which I wasn't really interested in at 12. And my grandmother loved reading like periodicals, like Time Magazine and Newsweek and stuff like that. My aunt read horror novels, and I loved loved horror movies as a kid. And so she gave me a copy of a book that she had just finished. And she said to me, I remember her saying, she's like, look, I'm going to give you this book. And it's really scary. If you get too scared, stop reading it. I'm like, okay. And I started reading it. And it was Salem's Lot by Stephen King. And it, to this day, is probably still my favorite horror novel. It's probably the scariest book, pound for pound, that I've ever read. And I remember it was in the summer. So my birthday's in August. So I think it was right before my birthday. So it's super hot down here in the South, but we're used to it. And I remember sitting on a porch. My grandma had a screen-in porch. It's the middle of the day, and I'm reading this book, and I'm halfway through it, and I got goosebumps because it's so terrifying, and it's so scary, and it's just so intense. And I think I got to the part, you know, spoiler alert, the book been out 40 years, so, you know. but there's a part where the Glick brothers are walking home from their friend's house after playing, and they're walking through the woods, and they take a shortcut. And it's pitch dark. And the two characters, the older brother is trying to convince his younger brother not to be afraid because he's afraid, but he doesn't want him to be afraid. And that resonated with me because I have an older brother. And that's something I could see my older brother doing, like pretending not to be afraid so I didn't get afraid. And just the intensity of that scene and how I remember the line where he said something to the effect, you know, they could see the lights from the backyard of their house and they were almost home. And he said, one of the characters says to himself, you know, he'll be glad to be home and he'll be glad to feel stupid for having felt afraid. Right as he writes that, the terrible thing happens. I'm not going to say what it is, but the terrible thing happens. And I knew from that moment on, I didn't know I've always wanted to be a writer. I think I'm rare in that. Not every writer feels that.
Right.
Way. I've always wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a writer since I was 6 years old when my mom got irritated with me for pointing out plot holes in the Three Little Pigs. Because I used to ask her whenever she'd read me that story, I'm like, why didn't they just build all the houses out of bricks if they already had bricks available? And my mom was like, why don't you write your own stories? Then you don't have to ask these questions. So I've always wanted to be a writer. But I think that moment, reading Salem's Lot, reading the doomed journey of the Glick brothers, made me realize what writing could do. Because the feeling that I had reading that book, reading that scene, it's something I wanted to give to other people. I wanted readers to read my writing and feel that way. Again, I'm not comparing myself to Stephen King. That, you know, he's a genius. But I wanted people to have that feeling about something I wrote. And I finished that book. I finished that book in 2 days. Oh, I wish I could do that now. I don't have that sort of...
You don't have 7 hours in the summertime on the porch?
I mean, I read it all that day, all the next day. I finished it at 12:30. At night, the next night. And I remember giving it back to my aunt. And she's like, did you finish? Like, yeah. She's like, is you okay? Is it too scary? I was like, no, that's fine. I slept with a silver butter knife and a cross made out of popsicle stick under my pillow for the next like 3 months. Because I just knew Ralphie Glick was going to come crawling to my window and scratching on the glass and I wanted to be prepared. But the thing about having a big imagination is you feel things very intensely. And so I was terrified. But I liked the feeling of being terrified. As an adult, I can look back on Salem's Lot and realize the reason I think I connected with it so deeply is because Salem's Lot is just like a town I grew up in. It's, you know, Salem, you know, Stephen King's from Maine. I'm from Southeastern Virginia. But there's a uniformity and an equanimity that exists in small towns, no matter where they're at. And Salem's Lot, the people in Salem's Lot, their slights, their loves, their hates. I knew people like that. And so that book, it resonated with me. I think when you read like something like Lovecraft, you know, and it takes place in like the early 1920s New England and a certain type of New England that I wasn't familiar with, or you read, you know, even great writers like Richard Matheson, that's sort of urban horror. But there's something about, you know, that pastoral horror of Stephen King that he's returned to time and time again, that really resonates with me as being a, you know, I go every time I read his books, I'm that 12-year-old kid sitting on the porch again. And I love that. And I hope that my writing gives people a similar feeling.
So was this your first Stephen King novel? Is this your first Stephen King novel?
The first book I ever read by him. Yep.
But not your first horror novel, or was it your first horror novel?
No, I had read horror novels like, you know, I love horror, I think, ever since I can remember. I love the sensation of being scared. Now, my grandmother used to tell us folk stories, like scary folk stories as kids. And so I love that there was one that is the, she used to tell us the story of the golden arm, which is this jump scare story, where it's this creepy story about this woman who has a golden arm, and she makes her husband promise if anything ever happens to her that he won't take her golden arm, and then she dies. And then he, of course, goes and digs the golden arm up. And then all that night, he hears this voice outside, you know, who has my golden arm? And of course, at the end of the story, there's a pause. And then if the storyteller is really good, and my grandma was really good, the pause lasts and it lasts. And then finally she yells, you've got it. And I remember just scaring her with Jesus out of us as kids. And I love that. And so I remember going to the book fair, you know, with like $5 and feeling like, you know, I was entering a Bugatti store. And I remember there was a, now I'm dating myself, tell you how old I am. There was a record that you could buy called Spooky Stories. Okay. It's a 45. You could put it on your record player. And it was just a bunch of old folklore scary stories. So I've always loved scary stories. The first horror novel I think I read on my own was, I believe it was, I want to say it was something by Shirley Jackson. My aunt was a big reader. She had a lot of old paperbacks that had these very garish covers. I remember she had The Face That Must Die by Ramsey Campbell, and had this loud, colorful, garish cover that, you know, stood out in a drugstore or a supermarket. Yeah. And so I got a lot of my horror novels from her, and all those were good. I enjoy them. But yes, something about Stephen King, that first novel by him was like, this is different. This, like, those novels unnerved me a little bit. This terrified me. This, like, I was terrified of those vampires in Stephen King's book. And, you know, I think something that he doesn't get enough credit for is sort of the sort of banalness of his characters. You know, there's vampires, there's werewolves, and there's girls with telekinesis and so on and so forth. But there's also, you know, bullies and Bill that they need. And, you know, there's sort of this thing where the real life horrors are parallel to the supernatural. And I think that's something that he does uniquely, or, you know, he at the time was doing uniquely. So yeah, that was my first Stephen King book, but not my first horror novel.
My working theory, and you can tell me if I sound like an idiot or it sounds like something maybe that's onto something, is there's something about those big Stephen King novels that has the greatest difference from when you're like just sitting there reading it and then you look up and you realize you're in the real world. Like, it's the first time people have that experience of like really being dropped and immersed. And then you can kind of sit up and then you go back down and like, it's a world of one. And you kind of realize for the first time how powerful it can be. Like, you can suck someone's consciousness in for 700 pages and it seems like magic.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think that's, you know, that's the power of writing. And I think there's something about his books that it's, you know, it's so comforting to just be in the hands of a master storyteller.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, you know, come here. I'm going to tell you a story for about, you know, a couple hours a day or maybe all day. And it's going to be fun. It's going to be scary. And you're going to really enjoy yourself. And I definitely felt that with Salem's Lot. That was the first time I really felt that sort of otherworldliness, that sort of slipping through the portal.
Right.
And he does that about as good as anybody that's writing.
And that's our show. Thanks to Rebecca Shinsky for coming back. She'll be back for the July books in a month. Thanks to S.A. Cosby for telling us that story. Go check out All the Sinners Bleed, coming out June 6th from Flatiron Books, and his other two books, Razorblade Tears, Blacktop Wasteland. You want to follow us? You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, link in the show notes there. Also doing a newsletter from time to time. It's a Substack. You can go check that out. Got a lot of nice comments on Apple Podcasts. People are leaving reviews, saying nice things. If you have a moment and like the show, that really does help us get guests, get in the algorithms, get people to find out about the show. Really appreciate all your time there. Also, I'm still working on this thing and I do love feedback. Email's the best way to do that. You can email me at firstedition@bookriot.com. That's firstedition@bookriot.com. And until next time, read something great.